You're listening to the Driving Net Profit with Zero Emissions podcast, a monthly show with best practice net zero stories of leading businesses responding to climate change. You're with award-winning author and 100% Renewables co-CEO, Barbara Albert.
Hello and welcome back to this latest episode of the Driving Net Profit with Zero Emissions show. I am Barbara Albert, co-CEO of 100% Renewables, a consultancy specialized in the development of climate action strategies. The built environment is a significant contributor to the global carbon footprint. It accounts for approximately 40% of our emissions. And here in Australia, 50% of electricity consumed is in buildings, such as homes, offices, warehouses, shopping centres, or hospitals. And on top of that, there are emissions generated through raw materials that go to construct these buildings. The topic of today's discussion is the need for the built environment to get to net zero emissions sooner rather than later. Joining me today is Bruce Precious. Bruce is widely respected for his achievements in the built environment sector to transform how the property industry responds to the most significant sustainability challenges. Bruce has seen and championed the evolution of green building ratings right from their inception in the mid-1990s to where they are today. In 2019, he was awarded the New South Wales Green Globes Lifetime Achievement Award, and in 2020, named a Green Star Champion by the Green Building Council of Australia. With a career spanning over 30 years, he is now Principal Consultant at Six Capitals Consulting. Before this role, he was GPT's National Manager of Sustainability and Property Services. Hi, Bruce, and welcome to the Driving Net Profit with Zero Emissions show.
Thanks, Barbara. I've been looking forward to our chat today.
As have I. Bruce, you and I have had numerous conversations and exchanges over the last years, and one of the key points that you argue is that the built environment should be going to net zero emissions sooner rather than later. That's going to be the topic of today's discussion. But first, I want our listeners to find out more about your background and expertise. You've been involved with the evolution of green buildings in Australia for more than 25 years. You have worked on the government side, you've worked with major property companies and with other key industry stakeholders. Can you take us on a quick journey through your work and your successes?
You make it sound like a long time, 25 years, and it is. One of the advantages of being old, if there is any advantage, is that you can look back and see what change has taken place over a period of time. And my history with buildings and efficiency in buildings goes back to the late 80s when I joined a controls company, Honeywell, working on installing intelligent building systems of the day, early microprocessor days. But that was a revolution in the control of large commercial property. And too often we worked so hard to put these highly efficient systems into place that rarely did we get to commission them and really get them to work to their optimal. You know, the builder was finished, they'd reached practical completion, the tenants needed to move in, so just turn everything on and leave the building. So I got my retribution over a little time when I joined the New South Wales Sustainable Energy Development Authority in the late 90s, which was a time where Kyoto was being negotiated, greenhouse was firmly on the agenda, and there was action required. And CEDA, as it was then, launched programs like Green Power, Energy Smart Business, a lot of programs that made a significant difference in the market, including what was called back then the Building Greenhouse Rating Program, or the Australian Building Greenhouse Rating, that became NABERS, a benchmarking program for commercial property, which has driven a massive, very significant change across particularly office buildings, but increasingly now shopping centres, data centres. They're moving into retirement, aged care. They have tools for hospitals and schools. It's been a joy to see the difference that benchmarking tool, something developed by government but adopted by the private sector, could make in terms of energy and emission reductions. And now we see that extended through to certification of buildings being net zero in operation. So that span over that period of time, it's been a very exciting time. It felt as though it was moving too slowly all the time, but now we look back and we can see that there's been some considerable movement and success along that way.
Yeah, it's great to see that kind of movement is happening in the Australian market. I'm very happy about that. So I wanted to talk about the need to decarbonize, the need to reach net zero emissions, and the developments that are happening currently and how this affects the built environment. So the need to decarbonize has evolved since even 2015 when the Paris Agreement got signed. The Paris Agreement said that we should reach net zero emissions by mid-century to limit global warming to under 2 degrees. And most countries have committed to this goal, as well as all states and territories of Australia. But then in 2018, we had the IPCC special report on global warming, which called for global warming not to exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius, and the big difference between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees. So this paper still calls for net zero emissions by mid-century, or if you go with no overshoot, around 10 years earlier. So it's a bit of a different message, making it more stringent. But then we also have the Science-Based Target Initiative, which is a great tool to help business plan its pathway towards net zero emissions, previously under the 2-degree scenario and now also under 1.5 degrees of warming. And then recently, the International Energy Agency issued this report where they're calling for no new fossil fuel power stations to be built if we are to achieve global warming targets. So clearly, global advice on when and how to decarbonize keeps changing. But all of this guidance still points to decarbonization and net zero emissions being required over the next 15 to 30 years. So do you think, Bruce, that net zero by 2050 is good enough for the built environment, or should the target year for the built environment be different in your opinion?
I think it's justified that the built environment moves much more quickly. And there will be, and this is a maturing of the discussion, so that we recognize those parts of our economy that can move rapidly and should move as early as possible, move with urgency. City of Sydney, for instance, in their climate emergency, they've declared they want the city to be net zero 2035. There's an expectation that some of these targets will continue to come forward as we recognise the urgency and as the opportunities to move away from a carbon-intensive economy come to fruition. Technologies change, behaviours change, and all of a sudden we can unlock different potential there. So rather than casting out these long-term scenarios, for many sectors of the economy, not just built environment, for many sectors of our economy, the question should be today, why not net zero today? If not, why not? So net zero today, if not, why not? Explain why not. Because...
Get around.
Yeah, for the built environment, if we take the operational emissions component of built environment, it's about reaching that point of having efficient buildings that run on renewable energy. Well, we can do both those things today, so why not do it today? So that's the overall message, I think, that we need to send and liberate large parts of our economy to make these changes at the earliest possible opportunity, because there will be parts of our economy that are really hard to abate. And that's in construction materials and in generation of a lot of the raw materials that our economy relies on. Now, there are strategies afoot for those, but they're going to take a little longer. But if everybody else that can move to net zero now does so at the earliest opportunity, not only do they get to sort of put that behind them and move on with their own innovations and their own business building, but we help the science improve the probability of avoiding those global warming impacts. So if you take the IPCC projections, for instance, when they talk about the calculation of 1.5 or 2 degrees, there's a probability around that. There's a 66% probability that we'll avoid 1.5 or 2 degrees. Well, that's not very good odds. Let's work at improving that probability by mitigating emissions much more quickly.
So in addition to this kind of moral imperative to act where you can act, is the sector under a lot of pressure from their stakeholders to indeed move to net zero emissions?
There is pressure for the large commercial property owners. There is significant stakeholder pressure, whether that's from investors. There's increasingly competition on the tenant side. So in commercial office buildings, to take the example, many of the large tenants in office buildings are setting their own net zero targets. So they have an expectation that they can move into net zero buildings. So if you want to optimize the performance of your building from a financial perspective, from a vacancy perspective, from a leasing space perspective, you want to make your building most attractive to the broadest range of tenants. So there's a portion of those tenants that are setting increasingly higher targets for the performance of buildings, and owners are responding to those pressures. Significantly within again those corporations, the employee group voices a significant degree of satisfaction around those organizations that are moving more quickly on carbon abatement, demonstrating that it's something that can be that net zero operations, for instance, is something that can be achieved in commercial property today.
Definitely. So, yeah, the built environment is under a lot of pressure from all sides of the stakeholder equation, from investors to tenants. There is pressure to move to net zero emissions. Let's have a look at how the built environment actually contributes to greenhouse gas emissions. But if I look at it, obviously, the sector uses a lot of energy to run the buildings, and there are also many emissions associated with the construction and also some at the end of life of buildings. Bruce, could you take us through the emissions that the built environment sector is responsible for?
So let's start with the, because there are a number of dimensions there to consider. So if we start with operational buildings, and commercial property typically has quite long lifetimes. So the when you look at the skyline of the city, the triumph of the city, as it's described in some places, mankind's greatest invention, some people have said, is the city, because it makes us richer, greener, smarter, healthier, happier. Those attributes, and people continue to flock towards cities around the world. So cities are comprised a whole bunch of buildings, typically quite long lifetimes, but it's the over that life cycle, it's the operational emissions that have historically been the most significant. So the things that we can deal with there, if we break it down into the scopes of emissions, scope one emissions being the emissions that occur on site at the building. So if I'm burning a fossil fuel at the building, a gas or diesel or any other kind of fossil fuel, I'm generating some scope one emissions. So I can do something about that today. I can use that system more efficiently to reduce emissions. And that's been a really successful strategy that improves neighbours' ratings and the benchmarking around the energy efficiency of buildings. But I can also today, I can make a determination that next time I replace that piece of equipment, and every piece of equipment in the building has got a life cycle to it. If I'm going to replace a boiler, for instance, I'm going to put a caveat on this old gas boiler that says, yeah, when I replace you, I'm going to replace it with an electric heating system that I can run on renewable energy. Mm. I can make that decision today so that I can put a defined timeline on when I will have eliminated those scope one emissions.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the kind of emissions, so you mentioned the scope one emissions, the diesel consumption that happens and the natural gas consumption, for instance, in boilers. And then you talked about the energy consumption, of course, which was the focus. Are there any others? We've got the energy-related ones. What about embodied emissions?
Let's keep with operational for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
So operational emissions, we've talked about scope one. Scope two is our electricity emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that we can revert to renewable energy. We can either install on-site solar systems on our buildings and many of the large shopping centres that have big roof areas have got, over a megawatt of solar installed now, and that continues to grow. And we can purchase renewable energy through the grid to supplement that on-site solar. So that's we can deal with our Scope 2 emissions today, and we can do that today. And that takes us to Scope 3 emissions. And Scope 3 emissions are those that occur not directly at our site, but as a consequence of the building. So upstream, we have suppliers that have emissions associated with them. Downstream, we have customers that have emissions associated with their use of the built environment. So those Scope 3 components are something that we can also, if not control, we can influence. And there's a range of strategies that we can employ around those Scope 3 emissions specifically. And we'll probably come to those a little later.
So it's always surprising looking at all these emissions that the built environment is responsible for, just to analyze all the different emission sources. So altogether, or maybe just specifically for operational emissions, how much exactly does the built environment contribute to greenhouse gas emissions overall?
So it's somewhere in the order of, in terms of total emissions, somewhere in the order of 40% of global emissions are related to the built environment.
Yeah.
In Australia, the Climate Works has done some work to suggest that the built environment's responsible for about 50% of the electricity consumption in the country. So a significant player, and built environment is everything from our homes to hospitals to schools through to commercial property, shopping centres, industrial and office buildings. So it's a very broad part of our economy and our communities. It's no surprise that it should be quite a large consumer.
Hmm. So they are a significant contributor, and so much can be achieved by moving the built environment to net zero emissions. So how can this happen? You talked about the scope one, scope two, scope three emissions and the different components of how the sector is responsible for greenhouse gas emissions. How can the built environment move to net zero, in your opinion?
I think we have this unique opportunity in Australia because we have the NABERS program that benchmarks and understands the energy efficiency. We have the right incentives to improve the energy efficiency of buildings, which is the first place to really start. And the next bit is to create a certification for net zero of buildings, a badge, so that if a tenant is looking to move into a net zero building, there's a badge that they can look for, or a certification that they can ask for, that gives them confidence that they're moving into a net zero space. And we have one of those. So the Climate Active program, run by the federal government, provides a description of the boundaries of a net zero certification for operating property. It's the only one that I can find in the world. And certainly when I speak to peers and colleagues in New York or London, they're very jealous that we have these definitions that we can work with and create a badge that people can ask for, which creates a market now. We've seen the market evolve and the market created around NABERS ratings. We can extend that now to climate active ratings, to net zero ratings, so that there is an active market, whether there is either if you are a net zero building, you either get a green premium in the rent, or probably more to the case, you avoid the brown discount that you will suffer if you're not a net zero building. So amongst the membership of the Better Buildings Partnership, which is a coalition that the City of Sydney draws together, there's around 13 property owners in that coalition that are responsible for 60% of the buildings in the City of Sydney. So imagine walking down Pitt Street or George Street in the city and 60% of the buildings around you are part of the Better Building Partnership. They've all committed to net zero 2030 or before. So we already have, through the Neighbours Climate Active certification, there's more than 30 buildings already certified as net zero now. And there's more that have been certified through the Green Building Council process as well. So it's a very rapidly growing certification space that is a great demonstration project, I think, to the broader community that just shows that this is something that we can do today, immediately.
Is it good enough to go net zero straight away because you have to use carbon offsets for that? What is your opinion on that?
Well, you don't have to use carbon offsets in every case. There's a large proportion of Neighbours rated buildings that are 100% electric buildings today. Mm-hmm. So for that most significant portion of the carbon footprint, you move to renewable electricity and you've resolved that problem. Within the boundaries of operational buildings, the climate active boundary does extend to some elements that are under the building manager's control, which include water consumption and the embedded carbon in that's involved in delivering and then treating water, and also the provision of waste services. So there is an element of scope 3 emissions that you may be, to be net zero today, you may revert to offsets.
Mm-hmm.
And in most cases, certainly the people I'm speaking to are talking about nature-based offsets. So offsets that come with a number of broader benefits on top of the carbon abatement piece. So I don't think there's a reason to be skeptical or scared of offsets. Offsets will form a really, really important part of moving our economies to net zero. There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the conversation is maturing, and the release late last year of the Oxford Principles on offsetting as a reference document, that document and the thinking behind that document providing us a taxonomy that helps us to understand the different roles of different offsets and how the roles of those offsets will change over time. That's a really, really useful reference to help guide our appreciation of offsets.
Definitely. So we mentioned earlier the pathway to net zero emissions. In my opinion, offsets should be one of the last considerations, and we touched on many of the opportunities that the built environment sector has to reduce emissions directly. You mentioned all electric buildings, which of course is great because it's so much easier to make electricity renewable as opposed to, for instance, natural gas consumption in a boiler. So taking it back again and just to uncover all the different solutions that exist in addition to offsetting and constructing a pathway to net zero, we talked earlier about the scope one emissions being diesel, being natural gas. We touched briefly on refrigerants. We've got the scope two emissions with electricity. We've got embodied emissions in the scope three and more. What would a good pathway to net zero look like that touches on all these emission sources, taking into account that most buildings at the moment are not just fully electric, I would imagine?
It's a pretty broad range, and with gas typically used to fulfill a heating requirement. You know, there's way more gas used in Melbourne in commercial property than there is in Brisbane, for instance. So it will change with our climate zones. There'll be different perspectives on that, but the fundamentals all remain the same. And the avoidance of emissions by cutting back use through energy efficiency is the I don't want to say the first step, because we need to take a whole bunch of steps concurrently. We don't have to strangle the last megajoule of efficiency out of a building before we go and purchase renewable energy.
Or put solar panels on, for that matter.
Put the panels on the roof. So there's a bunch of concurrent steps that we can take. Energy efficiency is a continuous improvement thing. Technology will continue to improve. Behaviors will change. The way we use buildings will change purely as a result of COVID, for instance. So keeping up with those, being flexible and nimble and keeping up with those changes, using buildings in different ways, will give us different opportunities for the continuous improvement of energy efficiency. And then we add to that electrification of any fossil fuel systems. So make that decision today to talk to the CapEx team or whoever manages the life cycle of that equipment inside your building. Put a big sticker on it that says, do not replace this gas equipment with like for like. Next time it fails or we need to replace it, it needs to be electrified. We'll start building the business case to electrify those fossil fuel systems. As we said, we move to the biggest step, the most significant, is to move to renewable energy. So if you have the opportunity for on-site solar, get that installed and move your contract across to a renewable energy contract, green power, or purchasing and retiring LGCs, large-scale generation certificates, is the mechanism. Again, be careful about that. If you're listening to information out of Europe and the US, they don't have reliable ways to purchase renewable energy on the grid. They don't trust their own green power schemes. Our scheme, our green power scheme, has been around since, I think it's 96 or 97, and it's national. I got sent to Washington in 1997 as a representative of the New South Wales government to pick up a US EPA award for Australia having the very first nationally consistent green power purchasing program, an audited, robust method for purchasing renewable energy over the grid. And, you know, that program has evolved and it's taken in the renewable energy target. We have really robust systems that we can rely on that other countries don't have. So other countries will talk about some of those strategies as being greenwash. We're here, they're not. So just be cautious around some of the perspectives from overseas. We have surprisingly, we have some really great advantages in our own market that we should use to our own advantage.
The Green Power Program is certainly a very respected program. We were involved with the program as well. We wrote the Green Power Guide for Businesses, so we'll put that in the show notes as well for people who want to find out more about this program that we have here in Australia. We talked about efficiency. We talked about putting solar panels on the roof. We talked about purchasing renewables through our renewable energy scheme here, which is great. So the LGCs that you mentioned is the renewable energy certificate equivalent here in Australia, which is a highly credible scheme. Is there any other way you can get carbon-free electricity?
Carbon-free electricity? There is labelled carbon-neutral electricity, mm-hmm. Which is not necessarily renewable electricity. So I think that, the emphasis needs to be on purchasing renewable electricity. That's the market transformation that our economy needs to move through and that we can accelerate by creating demand for renewable energy. So I think that's the question to ask your supplier, is to be sure that you're purchasing renewable energy. The carbon neutral electricity appeals to certain parts of the market, but if you're using offsets just to as an offset to carbon to coal-fired electricity, then that's not a sustainable long-term solution. We didn't really talk about the scope 3 emissions and our upstream and downstream, our upstream embodied carbon and downstream how our customers of the built environment can mitigate their emissions as well. So I really want to talk about upstream and what do we do about the carbon that's included in all of the stuff that we buy. So for the large commercial property owners, they have a significant spend on a whole range of products and services. How do we deal with that carbon? Now, traditionally, we've taken numbers like the spend on catering and flights and couriers and taxis and rental cars, and we convert that through some factors to create a carbon footprint. And then at the end of the day, the only thing we're left after we've done all that gruesome accounting is to purchase offsets. And that's a very unfulfilling, unsustainable approach to dealing with those embodied emissions.
It doesn't affect that much change in the economy either.
Mm. No, it affects none. So what we really want is for that courier to have delivered product, to have done his deliveries in an electric vehicle running on renewable energy. What we really wanted when we bought legal services was for that law firm to be a net zero law firm that's sitting in a net zero building that deals with net zero banks, and the banks themselves are net zero, providing services through to building owners. And it becomes a bit of a virtuous circle there. If property owners can ask their service providers to be net zero, and they in turn look for net zero buildings to be for their businesses to operate from, we've got a little virtuous circle that gets that demand for net zero products and services flowing. And again, we have this natural advantage over other countries where we have a climate active certification. We have a process for organizations to go through to get that label or badge that we can ask for.
And this process calls for on-site reduction, just like you mentioned. So rather than just offsetting to go to net zero, the process calls for efficiency to be put in and a focus on eliminating fossil fuels, just like you said. So it's rigorous.
And I think the focus will be extended and the emphasis will be much greater on the renewable energy component as well. It was originally called the National Carbon Offset Program. So it was designed very much with offsets in mind, but it has evolved and I think it will continue to evolve because stakeholders certainly want it to moving more towards that offsets as a last resort.
Mm-hmm. They should be a last resort indeed. So we were talking about the service providers, we were talking about upstream emissions. How can you, like thinking back of all the embodied emissions that the built environment has, all the steel, the concrete, the glass, the plastic, everything that goes into making a building, what can you do in this regard to incorporate that in your carbon footprint, incorporating that into the responsibility that you take for your building? What can you do to improve the carbon performance there?
Really important point. And I think we look to the, certainly in the commercial property world, we look to the Green Building Council and work collaboratively with the Green Building Council to provide the leadership and that point of collaboration on those elements. So for a start, do we need the materials in the first place? Can we dematerialize? Can we design lighter weight constructions? Can we move to timber construction? And in most capital cities now, I think there are some fabulous examples of mass timber construction, which is such an interesting and appealing method of building quite large scale properties that are extraordinary. But equally, we can continue to innovate in the way that materials are created. And you've seen, most people will have seen many messages to the market from those large scale steel producers, concrete producers are all working diligently now away at their How do we avoid emissions in our process? What does green steel look like? So that's the, you know, from a raw material to a building product phase, but equally then in sort of our operational cycle, then the whole notion of circular economy is growing in awareness across certainly the commercial property industry. And those three pillars of the circular economy with avoiding waste and pollution and keeping materials in use longer, and then regenerative environments, those three pillars really stand us in good stead. So organisations take Mervac, for instance, as a big commercial property player, recognise that they have create considerable demand for materials. They've set a target that 25% of their materials by 2030, I think it is, should be recycled materials. Now, that's something of an arbitrary number because nobody knows what the baseline is. So we don't know when we buy a product whether that product is virgin material or whether it's recycled material. And again, that's where our procurement strategies really come to play. If we start asking and creating demand and having disclosure of the provenance of materials, then we can influence that market and we create demand for recycled content, because we know that commercial property companies, along with lots of other businesses, have trouble dealing with their waste. They end up with waste product that they're trying to push out of the basement every night. And they, you know, we're caught now where there's seemingly decreasing demand for that waste product. But when we ask those companies, well, who should be creating the demand for that for that product to be recycled? Well, probably we should, because we buy a lot of that stuff. So putting in place that procurement strategy, creating demand for recycled product, creating demand for better stewardship of materials, working with those suppliers that commit to taking those materials back and reusing them again and recycling them into product that stays in use longer.
And setting those specific Scope 3 targets around that as well.
Exactly. So circular economy and net zero, that's a very big overlapping Venn diagram. So the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries and Energy, because that's what DPIE stands for, they just published their Waste and Sustainable Materials Policy 2041, and I really commend that as a document that, to my mind, breaks new ground in getting away from this, oh, we have a waste problem at the end of tailpipe kind of problem, and recognising that, no, we have a problem with managing materials. And I really commend the Waste and Sustainable Materials Policy to everybody that recognises. It recognises circular economy, it recognises net zero and how those strategies can work hand in hand.
Yeah, I certainly also want to applaud the New South Wales government on the release of this strategy, as well as the recent announcement on electric vehicle support.
Yay!
So exciting. You talked about upstream Scope 3 emissions a lot. Are there a lot of downstream emission sources? So, for instance, I'm thinking customer use of product. So, for example, tenants. How can you drive emissions reduction there? Or how would tenants be affected?
There's different tenants for different types of property, obviously. Look, I think let me back up a little bit and just remind everybody that if every organisation, if every person looked after their Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions, there wouldn't be any Scope 3 emissions. So the Scope 3 thing has different challenges associated with it. And, you know, the Neighbours program, when it was very first designed, go way, way back to when it was building greenhouse rating, it was initially designed as being a whole building rating. And when we took that to the to some people in the property council who knew how commercial property operated really well, they said, explain how this works and explain how tenants and landlords are going to deal with the energy that the tenants buy versus the energy that the landlord buys and manages. And when we described the collaboration that would be required between, you know, maybe 100 tenants in a large building and the manager to achieve an efficient building, that's where the advice was, you guys need to separate this out so you can allocate responsibility to the person who has control over it. And that was the wisest advice ever given for an energy efficiency program, because being able to define clearly the boundaries between what the landlord was responsible for or the building manager and what the tenant was responsible for has been one of the key components of the success of the Neighbours program. And the rest of the world wishes that they'd made similar decisions. In large parts of the world, talking to friends in New York, talking to people in London recently, they lament the fact that in many buildings, there's not even any meters that separate out what the tenant and what the landlord control. So yeah, nobody manages.
You can't manage what you don't measure.
Exactly. So we have these distinct boundaries of control. Now, can the landlord influence the tenant in how they use energy and how they create emissions? To some extent, but it's not the primary strategy for tenants. And lots of commercial tenants have got their own programs for net zero, for RE100 objectives, for instance. So there's a lot of activity in that space. The landlord's not always the best person to give that tenant advice on how to run their business. They're there to provide them space and let them get on with running their business. But they can influence and they can play a part. They can play a much more important part in helping those businesses deal with their waste, because the landlord becomes the person that comes in most examples, in large commercial property at least, you know, the landlord becomes the steward of the waste from all those tenants, and there's a lot more behaviour change, interaction that happens in those spaces. But it's not something to be ignored, but it's not our first strategy to rely on. Getting the landlord to be the benevolent landlord that forces the tenant to do a whole bunch of things in that space. That sounds very defensive after all of that big description. Which probably means I've failed to convince any tenant to ever do anything that I want. And probably reflects that a little bit. But I think it's something that we need to face into and probably look at the wider spectrum of strategies that we can use. One that we can use that's underused at the moment is Neighbours introduced a program called CoAssess. So there was a recognition that Neighbours' tenancy ratings are well behind Neighbours' building ratings, base building ratings. So tenants are not engaging in this space very well. So the CoAssess program allows, when the building owner has the Neighbours assessor coming in to do the rating of a base building, while he's there, he may as well do the tenant ratings at the same time. So CoAssess is a strategy to try and gain that greater engagement. And the proven mechanism, if you show somebody that they're a 2-star Neighbours building and everybody else is a 5-star, or, you know, 2-star just doesn't cut it these days, we have seen the influence that benchmarking can really have.
Just talking about the ratings for people who don't know, 2 stars isn't really great. We used to have 5 stars being the max, and now it's 6 stars. How good does a building have to operate to obtain a 6-star Neighbours rating?
It's a super level of efficiency. It has me reflecting again that when we introduced the 5-star rating, we were significantly challenged by the market by saying that the 5-star rating was going to be impossible for most buildings to achieve. It was just so efficient that certainly no CBD tower that, you know, is energy intensive, that has a lot of lifts and car parks and big air conditioning systems, you know, the thinking at that time was that only extraordinary buildings or campus-style buildings that are maybe out in the bush where they could open the windows and things would be five-star buildings. But, of course, we learned that over time we figured out lots of ways to make our buildings more efficient, to move, because the average building when it was first introduced was a 2.5-star building. So 5-star sounded extraordinary. But pretty soon we figured out 5-star, we could do that. And then a whole bunch of buildings were doing way better than 5-star. And a 6-star building uses half the energy of a 5-star building. So it's way beyond the realms of what people considered even feasible just 15 or 20 years ago. So that's enormous progress that, of course, helps us when it comes time to setting minimum standards. When we go to revise the building code, for instance, Australia is blessed in having the best set of information around operational buildings on which to base our future codes than any other country. So, again, we have this significant advantage in this space that our understanding has improved so much about how we use energy in the built environment space.
And talking about building codes, that brings up my final question for you, which relates to climate risks. I'm talking about physical climate risk. I want to find out more from you how you see climate risks applying to the built environment and how the sector is responding to those physical climate risks.
That's been a rapidly evolving space that's really been catalyzed by TCFD, another ugly acronym, but it's the Task Force for Climate Change Financial Disclosure. And TCFD is something that's driven by investors largely that want to know from businesses how they're responding to both the risks of the transitional risks of climate change. So what does moving to renewable energy mean for your business, for your sector of industry, but also what you're doing in relation to physical risks. So TCFD has had a lot of people who are largely already contemplating what global warming means to the physical assets, but TCFD has really given it a much, much greater momentum and push. So what I've seen happen in the marketplace, and many of the large commercial property owners now are releasing their TCFD reports. They're available on the website. They're being updated regularly. And we're seeing the response of designers. Design of air conditioning, for instance, has traditionally been done using historical weather records for an area, for a climate zone. Those historical weather records probably don't describe what our future weather is looking like. So there's been the move to changing design to reflect the projected weather. We've seen...
That's a great idea because we, as humans, we're so biased based
on our experience.
Yes. So we take past experience and think that this is going to... just be projected into the future. But, of course, that's not the case and everything is going to be exacerbated. So back to you. So you mentioned air conditioning.
So it's like we need the disclaimer on that's on our superannuation, isn't it? Past performance is no indicator of future. We just take that as read for everywhere. And then from a physical aspect, people like Stockland are a great example where they've developed their own checklist for physical risk, which looks at the surrounding environment. Are they exposed to bushfire? Are they exposed to flooding? Are they exposed to sea level change? Those broad brush kind of elements. But then looking at, okay, under extreme weather conditions, how do we ensure the integrity and the resilience of our built environment? So they have a checklist way of dealing with that. Different organisations I've seen have different methods of assessing, auditing the physical resilience. But again, it comes back to what are the things, what do we actually do about that today? So just like we talked about, today we can make a decision to go to renewable electricity and we'll make that change. That's something we can do today. Today, I'm going to include in my procurement guidelines that I would prefer net zero products. And equally today, I'm going to go and talk to the guys that manage the life cycle of my buildings, the capital expenditure team that look at the life cycle of a building. How old is it? When do we need to replace the roofing? When do we need to replace the guttering?
What's our management plan?
Yeah, what's our management plan for the building? And if I'm projecting I'm going to spend some money on the guttering at some point in the future, then when I redesign that guttering, then I should design it for the future climate, not the past climate.
And make it bigger because obviously the downpours are becoming more severe and more intense. That makes sense.
And that's the response. Now, I know there's a big response to, and again, it's our physical experience, there's a big response towards what are we going to do under extreme temperature conditions? Well, we already experience extreme temperature conditions. Buildings in Sydney are designed to achieve their 22 or nominal 22 to 24 degree comfort within the building, their design day is probably something like a 32 degree day. So buildings are rarely designed for the hottest days of the year because we know that that would just be a level of demand that is so immaterial given the whole year of performance of a building. And in any way, the building might just go to 25 degrees. Well, it's still a lot cooler inside that building than it is outside where it might be 45.
Yes.
So the daily temperature in extreme temperature conditions, yes, the building will be stressed and it will go beyond the design condition, but I don't think we need to have a knee-jerk reaction that says we need to design all of our buildings for 47-degree days.
Mm-hmm.
That would just end up in massively oversized equipment that would rarely come into use.
And cause even more carbon emissions.
Well, and it causes, and a topic we didn't discuss when we were talking about renewable energy, it causes incredible spikes of consumption on those hot afternoons. And that, you know, by putting in equipment that is so oversized, then we create this massive electrical demand. And then we're tearing our hair about because the electricity system doesn't cope. And our cities have the potential to be non-resilient, to be fragile. So from a resilience perspective, we can say, yep, under extreme temperature conditions, we can expect our buildings to be a little warmer. They won't be 22 degrees. They might be a bit warmer than that. That's okay. And buildings have a significant role that we should recognize as we transition to renewable energy. Buildings have a role to play in managing demand so that they can play a part in this extraordinary balance that we have got to provide every second of every day, where we balance how much energy our city uses versus how much energy can be transported through the distribution network and through the transmission network and can be generated. So that balance across all of that system is something that buildings can participate in. And I'd recommend the Better Buildings Partnership have released a demand management planner, which explains the role that not only buildings but any consumer can play in helping to balance demand, which helps to integrate more and more renewables into this incredible energy system that we've come to rely on.
It helps with grid stability because one of the other resilience issues, of course, is power outages.
Absolutely, absolutely.
How do building owners cope with that aspect, and would it all just be relying on diesel generators, which then cause additional carbon emissions under Scope 1? What can be done there?
It's interesting. We're doing some work with the Neighbours team at the moment in looking at how we better recognise renewable energy under the Neighbours program. And so some quick analysis we did just last week showed that lots of large commercial buildings, about 40% of rated office buildings don't have a diesel generator backup or have not used it in recent years. The other 60% have some diesel. The diesel consumption, which is predominantly used for testing, is I would describe it as immaterial. It's less than 1% in most cases, less than 1% of emissions when you look at the emissions footprint. So if we're using that truly only as an emergency supply, then I don't think that we shouldn't have knee-jerk reactions around that. I think there is an opportunity to rethink how we deal with power outage in office buildings, because at the moment there's a property council guide to office quality that defines how much generation a premium building, how much generation and how much on-site fuel capacity must be included in a premium building, what defines a premium building in that space. But it was designed, that standard was designed back in the day when we had large parts of, computer systems that we were totally dependent on sitting inside of buildings, for instance. And now with most things captured in the cloud, everybody in the building, we've just had the very clear experience of everybody working from home, or your laptop is going to keep working. Your laptop is battery backed for some time. You can keep working on the laptop if you've still got mobile communication or network communication anyway. So times have changed, and there is an opportunity to rethink what we need to support and back up in buildings and how we do it. So the rise of batteries and the opportunities that batteries provide to not only provide backup, but also to contribute to balancing the grid is a really important evolving consideration right now.
Excellent. These are all such good considerations and have given our listeners a comprehensive understanding of the physical climate risks and how they relate to the property sector and the built environment. What is the key takeaway message you want to leave our listeners with? We've covered so many topics around what causes emissions in the built environment, how the built environment can move to net zero emissions, and the importance of doing it sooner rather than later. We touched on physical climate risks. Out of all these topics that we've discussed, what would be your key takeaway messages you want to leave our listeners with?
The key message for me is net zero today. And if not, why not? And so if you can't do it today, what are the steps that you need to put in place so that you can do it tomorrow or the next day? Because it's not an infinite scenario, and it's certainly not let's just wait until 2050 and see what happens. Any business that has customers will be under pressure to be net zero sooner or later. Any business with investors, any business that has stakeholders, including employees or a community that it touches, will be under pressure to be net zero. The best way for you to respond to that is to say, okay, I need to be net zero today, and if not, why not?
Such a great key takeaway message. Thanks, Bruce. So how can people connect with you to learn more about net zero in the built environment?
Yeah, happy to take questions and suggestions and challenges and discussions anytime. So either look me up on LinkedIn or send me an email, simply bruce.precious@gmail.com. I'd be happy for anybody's communication, and always happy to talk about net zero and how we accelerate net zero.
And I certainly appreciate our discussions that we have around this topic. You've mentioned a whole raft of documents that are available online. We're going to put these in the show notes as well as your contact details.
Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you.
That was Bruce Precious talking about the importance of the built environment moving to net zero now. if you know another person who you think will enjoy this podcast, please let them know so that more people can hear about best practice stories of how organizations are moving to net zero emissions. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you in the next episode.
As always, you can find more information in the show notes of this podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please rate and review it on your favorite platform. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to having you on our next show.